The contents of this interview, or from Awake and Empowered Expo LLC from Ethan Fox and Flower of Life Center for Human Evolution, is for informational purposes only and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints held by these organizations or individuals. Always consult with your doctor or health professional before making any changes to your diet, lifestyle, or prescription drug use. Please understand that you assume all responsibility and risk for the use or misuse of this information.
Welcome to Awake and Empowered Radio. This is Ethan Fox. Today I have the great pleasure of speaking with John Durash of the National Liberty Alliance, a U.S. national movement toward the reinstatement of common law. In this interview, we delve into what is common law, how it differs from the current legal system, and how it will restore power back into the hands of the people of the United States. Thank you, John, for taking time out of your very busy schedule to speak with me today and answer all these questions that I have about the work that you're doing and this incredible movement that's happening in the United States toward greater levels of freedom for people. And can you tell me a little about how you came to be the founder and leader of this movement to reinstate common law in the United States?
Well, I guess it really started my interest here. It was back in the 90s when I was being harassed by the IRS, and my communications with them was very alarming. I discovered that they weren't concerned in anything that anyone had to say, and they were just interested in what they wanted to get out of you. That kind of fell by the wayside as time went on, and I don't know why that happened, but I guess they lost track of me and they left me alone. But over the years, they've come out after me, but they've never been successful to get anywhere until recently. And then I ended up in court with them, and they dismissed it within 30 days. That's what started me off in wondering and questioning what was going on in our country. As time went on, I found things quite disturbing. You know, with the internet, particularly, you're able to find a lot of stuff. You go out into YouTube, you see a lot of these videos, different documentaries. You know, I found the interviews by Griffin, G. Ed Griffin, and that was very impressive. The interview, not the interviews, but the documentaries he did, and interviews. He was very impressive in the way that he produced some of this stuff. And I started to realize that there was a conspiracy in our country, in our nation, and that there were people that were determined to take this nation down. And I've done everything I could over the years trying to alert others, and things went on, and very few people responded, but some people did from time to time. And then it was with the Ron Paul movement that I was able to really get involved with a lot of people who understood what was going on and was trying to do something, and mostly that's why they were trying to get Ron Paul into the presidency. Back then, I think we were naive enough to think that that we could save the nation by getting Ron Paul elected. I guess it would be a really good first step, but he by himself could never have done it. But nevertheless, how things went, he didn't make it. After that, the Tea Party movement started. So I went from that to this, to the Tea Party movement. And then I met an individual up north. Goodness, what county did he come from? Niagara County. And his name was Lenny Roberto. And he had a program. I heard him talk down in Albany at some rally. And he impressed me. It was a two-minute speech, but he really impressed me because he was offering something to do. And so I gave him a call after the event and told him I was interested. He invited me out to his house. He was doing a seminar maybe a month or two later, and he was teaching on the committee man process. And so I started my research in the committee man process. I didn't get a lot of information. There was some stuff in the election law you could find, and everything else was really party rules. But I knew there was a problem because it didn't match between the law and the party rules. So we ended up doing some research. We went up into the archives up in Albany, New York here, and we discovered that the committee man was a facade, that the committee man actually was not elected, and they created this facade or this straw man. And people think they're an elected individual, but they're not, and they have no power, and they really owe everything to the party itself. And that's why these two parties that rule our country, the Republican and the Democratic parties, they're a top-down structure. They both run just like no different than the Communist Party, total control. And if you don't behave and keep in line, they just kick you out. And I even asked the question, how can they possibly kick out someone who is elected? Why is it top down? Why don't we have say in everything? But I discovered all of our government is running that way. And I discovered ultimately that we're in corporatism. Corporatism is synonymous with Nazism. And I discovered that the United States was incorporated. Every state in the union was incorporated. The counties are incorporated. The towns, the cities are incorporated. They're all incorporated. And when you go in, and all the police departments work for corporations, and it's all about making money. And so all these courts that are set up, in these town courts, the city courts, they're all what's called nisi prius courts. They come to being through statutes. And they operate by statutes, and they control the behavior of people, and they bring them into these courtrooms, and it's all about money. And so we started to come to realize a lot of these things because we started to have – we took a case up to the New York Supreme Court on the committee man to get the elected committee man recognized again. And we sued them in 2011. We sued the New York State Board of Election. We sued them in 2011, and we sued them again in 2012. And nobody was interested. They weren't interested in obeying the law. The court wasn't interested in hearing the case, and they did everything they could to get rid of us. We ended up in the appellate court, made some arguments there, and we found out that the appellate court was just as corrupt as the trial courts, which was quite alarming to me because I kind of thought we did have a good justice system. But I didn't have any experience there. And I figured, yeah, there's probably some corruption there, but never thought that they were all corrupt. And I know that's a bold statement, but I'm still looking for an honest person in the courtrooms. I haven't found them. I haven't found a good judge, and I haven't found a lawyer. Not that they don't exist. I just haven't met them or had any exchange with any of them. But anyway, this led us into the common law when very early on we started to realize that we should be under common law because of our research and the Constitution. Declaration of Independence is a common law document. A Bill of Rights is a common law document. Constitutions are common law documents. So we realized we should be under common law, and they weren't taking us under common law. They were under statutes. So we started to do a lot of research, and we started to do a lot of studying, and then eventually we came up with the grand jury I think it was the early part of 2013. January, February, March, April, I guess around April, March or April, we started looking into it. Someone sent me a copy of United States versus Williams. So I read through that case and I was just blown away. That night, I literally stayed up all night going through this case and just tearing it apart, researching all of the other cases that Scalia had referenced to. And it was a 6-3 decision. And it was so powerful. And I shared it with an associate of mine that works with me with the National Liberty Alliance, Gerard. And he also stayed up all night working through it. And at that point, we decided this was the way to go. So we had networked throughout all of New York, and we had a lot of connections because we were taking people through the committeeman process. We were teaching people how to become elected committeemen while we were fighting in the courts. And we were involved. We brought Democrats and Republicans together. We were looking into the political process without the politics. So there was no party, bickering. It was all about let's get the Constitution back in play. But anyway, we kind of changed gears when we saw this. So we started to tell everybody about this grand jury, and we started to organize throughout New York. And we elected our first common law grand juries here in New York. I believe it was June 20th, I think was the first one, which was Dutchess County. Orange County followed a week later. And before the end of August came, we had, I think it was 14 or 15 common law grand juries. We have grand juries in 4 of the 5 boroughs of New York City. The only one we don't have is in Richmond. We have both counties on Long Island, Nassau and Suffolk. We have all of the counties north of the city and south of Albany all in the game. At this point, we now have 18. But anyway, kind of early on, I guess around maybe May, before we actually elected the first grand jury here, we started to realize, because we're having meetings every Monday night online, and teaching people what we could, and developing the website that we now have. And we changed the name of the website at that point from NewYorkCommittee.org to National, well, actually it was New York Liberty Alliance. And so it was NY Liberty Alliance. But we started to notice that we were getting a lot of people visiting us from other states, and they were interested in what we were doing. So, you know, I gave people permission to clone the website, whatever they wanted, just clone it. And I would clone it for them. I have a program that can clone it. But people really didn't know what to do. They were learning, and I kind of realized that maybe I should create the website in such a way that's more to the national and not just focusing in on New York. And we started to get more and more people from outside, and they just were very interested. So we changed our name to NationalLibertyAlliance.org, and we became a national movement. So we were kind of drafted into the national movement. Our intention was to create 62 common law grand juries here in New York, 62 counties. And then at that point, we thought that when people saw what New York had done, when we start to free the courts and bring them back to courts of justice again, that they would try to emanate us, and we would spark the movement across the nation. But it didn't work out that way. Instead, we got involved with the entire nation. And today, we are in every single state. We have some states will probably get done before we will. Arizona will probably complete their elections before New York does. I believe they have 15 counties, but they have 7 elected. They had 3 more elected. I think they're coming either today or next week. They'll have 3 more, so they'll have 10. So they'll only need 5 more. Down in Florida, I believe we have 11 elected down there right now. But they're working in 33 counties and putting them on the books. So I think in the next 30 or 45 days, they're going to have about 40 grand juries down in Florida, common law grand juries. We also believe by the end of February we'll have pretty much all of the counties of New York completed. That's our hope. I've been kind of too busy to focus in on it, but I did find a couple of people who are working very hard the past couple of weeks now and starting to organize New York. And again, we've got all the people. We just got to make the dates and get them organized and get it done. So I think we're going to accomplish that. Pennsylvania is moving in quite a good speed. I don't remember how many counties they have elected, but they got quite a few, and they're moving forward pretty quick also. But again, we're in all 50 states. We're in Hawaii. We're in Alaska. And we're from California to New York and everything in between. So, people are moving on this, and it's because of the message, you know, the purpose of the common law grand jury is to repair or fix any wrongdoing it finds, whether it be in a political or judicial realm. And when people understand what that means, they understand that's how we take our country back. And, you know, the key thing, we as a people, or our government, let's say, the people who work in our government, they will be as honest and as just as our court system. And our court system is a mess. These are courts of injustice. I can't even begin to tell people what goes on in these courtrooms. It is just alarming, extremely alarming. But when we can bring justice back into these courtrooms, and by the way, the meaning of justice in Black's Law Dictionary is synonymous with virtue, and certainly you'll find no virtues in these courthouses. But we intend on bringing it back, and when we take control, the people take control as far as the process being back into a common law process and procedure, that's when we'll have honesty and we'll have justice again in our courts. And then, of course, that'll emanate all through the political realms because the people are back and they're not going to put up with it no more. And we have the power and the authority to indict them and put them in jail if it's necessary. We can ask, the grand jury can question anybody anywhere in government, and they have a duty to answer. And if they're in contempt of the grand jury, we can put them in jail till they answer. So it's a pretty powerful thing that the people have that they don't know about, and we're trying to reveal it to the people, and people are catching on. It's moving through the country. We're being assaulted by lawyers, of course, and, of course, judges. But that's pretty much a quick rundown of how we got to where we're at.
Can you give us a really simple explanation, if that's possible, of what exactly is common law and how does that compare to the current legal system that we have in the United States, and really why would we want common law over what we have?
Right. Well, you know, the current legal situation right now is what's called the Nisi Prius court system. They really don't want to deal with common law in any way. They operate off of statutes. So the legislators make all these rules and laws, and they call them laws, but they're really statutes and codes. They don't apply to the people. They only apply to the bureaucrat, to the elected individual, and so on. So they don't apply to the people, but they've convinced the people, because they've dumbed us down so much, that they do apply to us. So they control us. And they're not interested in justice. They're interested in money. And I can tell you, everything in every court is about money. And that your court case will go as long as your money goes. And when you run out of money, your court case is over. And that's it in the lawsuits. In the criminal realm, it's all about fining you and putting you in jail. I'm not going to get into the SESQ funds or any of those things, but people need to look into what that's all about. When they put you in jail, they're able to draw money off your SESQ funds. And money goes into the town. It goes into the court. The judges get 20% of whatever they take out of your SESQ funds. They take 20% of that. That goes into their retirement funds. And a lot of the other stuff, the same thing, goes into the town. Even the state gets a piece of the action. And we believe the federal government even gets a piece of that action. So it's all about money. There are trillions of dollars being made in these court systems. In states alone, New York State alone, they're in the trillions. And so you can imagine what it is throughout the entire nation. Now, again, they're interested in arresting people, fining them, and or putting them in jail. Common law is not interested in those things. Common law is about justice. There are two maxims that govern the jurist in common law. One is, in order for there to be a crime, there must be an injured party. No injured party, no crime. And the state cannot be that injured party. The second maxim that's very important is that for every injury, there must be a remedy. So you see, common law is all about restoring the individual. If an individual has been damaged by another individual or by the government, they have to be repaired. And it is up to the jury and often the person who's been injured to try to discover what it is it's going to take to repair that person. The grand jury has the ability to negotiate that kind of a thing between the defendant, the one who assaulted or whatever, and the injured party. And if they can come to an agreement, then there would be no need to send them into court because, again, the whole thing is about finding justice and then making sure that justice is fulfilled. In common law, everything you do everything you can to keep people out of jail. It's not about sending people to jail. Of course, violent crimes, people need to go to jail. They're violent people. That's what jails are made for. And I would add to that judges. And the reason why I would add judges to that is because they've destroyed so many lives. They've committed so much violence against so many people, against families, children. If you go into the family courts, you just sit there and weep. When I started to see what was going on in the family courts, I had restless nights. I was weeping all the time. I just could not believe the destruction of people that these people have. And it's all about money, and they just don't care. These people are like, they're inhuman, it almost seems like. They go to work, and they're just blank to it. But anyway, that's the major difference. One is about justice. The other one's about money, and I think that just sums it up.
And where exactly did common law originate? How did it end up being the basis of the Constitution and the original founding of the country?
Common law, you know, originated ultimately up on a mountain with Moses. It's Mosaic law. That's where it came from. And our founding fathers studied the Bible in order to understand that kind of, where law comes from. You know, common law is natural law. And natural law, obviously, is law that was created by our creator, the governor of the universe. And so that's where it really started from. But here in the United States, the Anglo-Saxons came to England first, back around, 300-400 AD. And when they came to England, they came to England with an idea of being governed by the mind of God and not by the mind of men. And so it was kind of a fascinating idea. And so they were looking for maxims. They believed in absolute truths that could be found, that could, you know, that people could not argue. An example of a maxim would be, water cannot run uphill. Nobody could argue that point. A thing similar is not necessarily the same thing. No one can argue that point. And when you read the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal and we're endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. Those are maxims. Man doesn't get to rule over men. God rules over men. And, of course, when you go through the Bible, you start to see how God has set things up, and he was the king, and he was to rule. They constantly go off to kings and men that became kings, and that was a big problem that took place with Saul. And God kept telling the people, you know, I'll be your king, but they wanted a man, and so God said choose one, and they chose Saul, and they had all kinds of problems. And then God rose up David to reflect himself. And so, basically, you know, we need to be ruled by God. That's what the Bible teaches us. And that's what these people were looking for. So when they came to England back around 300-400 A.D., they did find themselves with the Bible. And they didn't recognize any written word as being the law. They believed, again, in maxims and principles. And they believed that they found those maxims and principles in the Bible, so they accepted the Bible as a common law document. And so I guess you would say that the Bible is the first common law document. This came to sort of a head back around 1215 with the Magna Carta, where the freemen, they were being assaulted by the king. They wouldn't get the recognition of their freedom, and the king was just out of control. Now, originally, the king was set up to represent the people. And we know how that always goes. Over time, it becomes corrupt. And that's what happened. Eventually, they got themselves a corrupt king. And he was not respecting what his job was to represent the people. When people had a problem, people who were freemen, people who came, stepped up and recognized their freedom and grabbed hold of it, they were called freemen. And so you'll see them in the names of dukes or nobles and different people of that type. But in any event, that's where it kind of started from. And so if they had a problem, they would hunt down the king to get into the court and get into the king's court and bring their case before the court, because they knew that the king would always rule for them as long as their case was righteous. And that's the key, because it was all about justice, synonymous with virtue. And so no one would bring a case into the court. No righteous man or free man would bring a case into the court unless it was a righteous case. And so they got justice in the king's court. And in 1215, the king got so out of line that 25 men came together, and they hunted down the king on the road. They pulled his carriage aside. They pulled out the axe. They put it to his head. They put the paper before him, which we know today as the Magna Carta. And they said, sign or lose your head. And that's how we got the Magna Carta. Of course, he signed. Now, they revised that a little later. They went a little overboard. They agreed that they should not have threatened the life of the king, at least not without the process. So they changed that they would never again go after the life of the king or affect his family, but they would take his castles and anything he had if he was an unrighteous king. And so anyway, that is, from there is where we stemmed our common law. Our founding fathers, you know, of course, we were colonies from England, and we were a mixture of different people, but nevertheless, it was an English rule, and we had the English common law, and that's what we had in this country. Our founding fathers cut their intellectual teeth, so to speak, off of the 17th century intellects, the great works, philosophers, 17th century philosophers. And so if you go back and read these people, and we have all their works up on online, New York, on nationallibertyalliance.org, if you start reading these papers, you start to realize where they started to get some of their words. You know, we quote Jefferson and Washington and Franklin and Madison and all these people, and actually they were quoting others. So they were very well learned. They were readers, and they established what we have today. And it all starts off with the Declaration of Independence. And the Declaration of Independence clearly says that we have government by the consent of the people. And that's the key word, by the consent of the people. And the question is how can the people possibly consent to the government we have today? And therein is the grand jury. They've hidden that from you. The Constitution starts off in the preamble, you know, we the people established and ordained this Constitution for the United States of America. The people are above the Constitution. The government is below the Constitution. They are the servants and we are the masters. Well, again, how do we rule? How do we rule these people as masters? It brings us right back into the judicial system. If the people control the judicial system, that's where we give consent or no consent. If people control the judicial system, that's where we control these people, then we will control all of government. And so that's the key, and that's how really a quick kind of a synopsis of, you know, how we got common law here in America.
The Constitution speaks of people. What exactly is the difference between the people and what is known as a citizen of the United States?
Well, that's a good question, and that's we have been defrauded. We the people have been defrauded. Back in the 1860s, they wrote the 14th Amendment. And before they wrote the 14th Amendment, they started to play with words. And we know this. You know how they play with words politically. They change the meanings of words, and they get these very, very creative ideas to make it look good. For instance, free choice. Who can argue with that statement, free choice? I mean, hey, I'm for free choice. You know, my choice is, in my case, I wouldn't do an abortion. But, of course, you know, they play with these words. And that's what they did. They started this probably started playing with the words back in the 1700s. You know, we got Blackstone, Black's Law Dictionary. We got Brovier's and even Webster's. And they were moving in light speed, so to speak, to try to get the meanings of words down on print so it wouldn't change. And they did a very good job on it. But over time, they've started to work in those dictionaries to change the meanings of these things, and they started to drop out court cases that gave the meanings of these things. By the time you get to the fifth edition of Black's, it really starts to get pretty bad. But the fourth edition is in pretty good shape. You get some good stuff out of the fifth, too, but it's really starting to deteriorate. But anyway, they started playing around with words, and they played around with the word citizen. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being a citizen. I'm a citizen of New York. But if you go into court as a citizen, you're automatically put under the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment makes the citizen subject to the government, subject to the government of the United States. You see, we started off as the people above the Constitution, who authored the Constitution, who ordained the Constitution. And now, all of a sudden, we have a situation where the 14th Amendment says that we are that we have to obey, we give consent and subject to their rules or their statutes, and they give us privileges instead of rights. And so you have to be very careful when you go into a court because they play the word game. And that's why when I go into a court, I say, you know, that I'm one of the people of New York, and that says it all. I don't have to say any more. You know, some people go to extremes and, you know, they say they're a son of God, they're one of the free men, I'm a flesh and blood of the soil, and there's no need for any of that. And of course, everybody thinks you're crazy when you do that. I understand what they're doing, and I agree with what they're doing, but there's no need to do that. Just have to say you're one of the people, and then you claim that this is a court of record and that you're suing somebody. A court of record, according to Black's Law Dictionary, is a common law court, proceeds according to the common law. And then, of course, I usually put that in there anyway, those quotes and court cases and Black's Law, you know, definition of the court of record. You know, the people, look, everyone is one of the people. The poor citizens are one of the people, too, but they've been defrauded and they just haven't realized it yet. When they come to understand it as they're being fleeced in the courts, especially the town courts with all these tickets and you know, violations and stuff, it just goes on and on and on. And even they bring up misdemeanors and felonies, which they have no authority to make any, to give a jail sentence or a fine. And the law is clear on that. But they do it anyway. But when the people are in these courts, they have no clue. But from time to time, someone wakes up and realizes, wait a second, I'm one of the people. I've been defrauded. I'm free. I have unalienable rights, and they can't take that away from me. And then you stand up and you debate them and argue them. You know, a Nisi Prius court is a court that is created by statutes and operates by statutes. And the definition of a Nisi Prius court is one that proceeds first unless you object. So as soon as you walk into a courtroom, the very first thing they ask is, how do you plead? Oh, I plead not guilty. You just consented. And you're done. You cannot consent. You do not plead. You're there on special appearance, which means you're here just to test whether this summons is legal or not. And because if you don't show up, they'll either find you guilty if it's just a very simple traffic infraction, or they'll send someone out to arrest you if it's something a little more serious. So you have to deal with them one way or another. You got to go to the court. And that's the difference. One day I woke up and realized I'm one of the people. When I started to study in this, I just declared my freedom, and that's it, to myself. I didn't have to declare it to no one else. I live and act free now. I go into a court and I deny them any authority over me. They have no, I'm not subject to them. They have no personam jurisdiction over me, and I let them know. And I will make my argument in court and make it clear. And if they don't set me free, I sue the judge and the prosecutor and anybody else involved. And that's the only way to get your freedom.
You touched on briefly the difference between a privilege and a right. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. A privilege is something that is given to you. You have a privilege. You're a member of some group or something, and from being a member, being a citizen, they give you privileges. And so they codified the rights. They call them civil rights. So they codified them. And that means they wrote codes to protect your rights. Well, he who giveth can taketh. When you have unalienable rights, that comes from God, the Creator, and no one can take them away. They cannot be violated. The Bill of Rights do not give us rights. The Bill of Rights protect our rights. So I have unalienable rights protected by the Bill of Rights. So if they violate my Fifth Amendment right or my First Amendment right or my Second Amendment right, well, I let them know they violated my unalienable rights protected by whatever amendment it is, you know, the Bill of Rights.
We've been trained as a country to think that democracy is actually a good thing, but can you explain what exactly is a democracy and how that differs from republic?
Well, yeah. You know, Benjamin Franklin defined it this way. Democracy is two wolves and a lamb deciding what they're going to have for dinner. A republic is a well-armed lamb debating the decision. So democracy is what the people want as a whole. And if 51% of the people decide that you can't have a right to a Second Amendment right, for instance, to have a weapon, then you can't have one in a democracy. In a republic, you can have 99.9% of the people decide they don't want you to have a gun, but you're in a republic, you have a right to have your unalienable right, you get your gun. So you don't participate. In a republic, you don't participate with anything you don't agree with, and you fall under the common law. And, of course, the key thing to common law is don't violate another human being. If there is no victim and you don't harm nobody, and that includes morally, you know, you can corrupt the morals of a child, for instance, by doing different things. You know, just drinking alcohol in the street is corrupting people, particularly children that walk in that same street. So that's why, you know, a law or a requirement that you not drink in public is good, because you're demoralizing the people if you do. But it's not against the law to drink. They make an age, that makes sense too. Those kind of things, of course, would stand up to logic in common law. You know, you come to a red light and people are crossing, it makes logical sense. I agree with the red light system. I agree you should stop. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they haven't seen a soul passed by in 15 minutes, and I come to and you hear crickets, I mean, and you stop at a red light, no one's there. Well, you stop, look, and go. I that sounds logical. Shouldn't be able to be violated by any policeman because you did that. So carpet law is common sense. So the key thing is, the key difference is a republic is really freedom under common law, and we're protected by a constitution. But again, the constitution is, and the bill, which in our case, the Bill of Rights particularly is what's important to us. That doesn't limit your rights. That's just the beginning of your rights. My rights is everything I say it is, and that's in a republic. But of course, the democracy is a different way. You know, democracies are, our founding fathers hated democracies. They did agree on making certain decisions in a democratic way, and they tried to neutralize it in different ways. For instance, they set up representation, okay, and we have congressmen, and that's usually by the population. So so many people get a congressman. New York, I know they had 29. I think they're down to 27. I think they were recently reduced because the governor chased so many people out of our state, I guess. But anyway, they were recently reduced. So I think we got 27 congressmen. So we have 27 congressional districts, and they represent us in Washington. Now, the Senate, we have, each state has two Senates, senators. And originally, the Constitution lays it out that these two senators, they are elected by the state Congress. So our state assembly and our state Senate elect those two senators to go to Washington. And that is really a really good check, because you see, if the people make the mistake with their congressmen, the legislators of the state can correct that mistake, because in Washington it takes both houses to approve a bill or something. Same way is a checkpoint also if the legislators make a mistake, you know, the senators of the legislators make a mistake, the people can put a check on it through their assembly and prevent the bill from going through. So it was a nice checkpoint, and I think it was the 17th Amendment that turned that around, which is totally illegal. Reason being is that the body of the Constitution cannot be changed. So once we get common law back, we do have to return back, because it's a wrongdoing that they've made that change. And the people now elect that by population. And they did that purposely because they're able to manipulate the vote a lot easier of the people than they could the vote of the Assembly and the Senate within the states. And so it was a lot easier also to control 50 senators than to control, my goodness, I think it's 430 congressmen in Washington. And then eventually, of course, they controlled the Congress, the progressive movements. And that progressive movement, of course, is in both parties. So anyway, the progressive movement used this, and of course they were behind this ultimately a long time ago, to destroy this balance of power. But that's about the only thing we have with democracy. You know, we get to elect certain people, but we also get to control them. And that's where the grand jury is. And the elected committeeman gets to control them also, because they get the opportunity to put the people on the ballot. And they can look for good, morally minded statesmen and put them on the ballot instead of criminals. Because right now we have people coming into office that are controlled by criminals who are controlling the parties, and I call them criminals purposely, because they're doing criminal acts, and so they've taken control and defrauded us all. So they control who goes into office, and ultimately, you know, the upper link, the people behind our government, there's people behind our government, we're actually an oligarchy. Democracies is the first step to an oligarchy. An oligarchy is a dictatorship. Eventually it unfolds as a dictator. So, but in any event, and that's where we're at right now, in any event, we do get to elect certain people, and the system was set up to prevent certain things from happening and to control these people, and that has been totally destroyed. The committee men are not grassroots. They don't get to really choose who gets into government, and the people who own this country, they really don't care whether the right gets elected or the left. And if you notice, when your party gets in, if you're still a party people, you'll discover they don't ever do what they say they're going to do, and it still gets worse. For the next one that comes up, it just keeps getting worse and worse, and we're in a slow burn. And we're about to collapse. America's about to be lost forever. And in my opinion, it could be this year. And we're in a race to save this nation. You know, you mentioned country, and I have too on a couple occasions because I'm so used to that. I always try to correct that and say nation, because the United States is not a country. The United States is a nation. New York is a country. Texas is a country. California is a country. We are the United States, United Countries, and we act as one nation. And the beautiful thing about America is that I can get up tomorrow morning, literally get up tomorrow morning, pack a bag, move to Jersey, and I'm a New Jerseyan. Once I put my roots in, I'm a New Jerseyan. Or I can travel through New Jersey and file a court case in New Jersey, and I have all the rights of a New Jerseyan. Okay, and that's the beautiful thing about America and the nation that we live in. We're a people that are brought together under certain principles, particularly justice, natural law. And once we've lost that, we're losing connection to all of us. We've lost that connection. We need to get it back.
I have a couple of hypothetical scenarios just so we can understand a little bit better how common law would actually function in society. So let's say in one example, we have somebody who's speeding through a subdivision, but no one actually gets injured. Would common law not have been broken in that case because no one was injured? And how would a common law grand jury handle that situation?
Right. Well, they had put people in danger. Sure, they could be stopped by a cop, and they should be. And they should be given some kind of a summons to go answer. That would be perfectly correct. And they could be brought before the grand jury. You remember, you have to still be brought before the grand jury. And it was society that was had potential injury from this, so the grand jury has got to answer for this. You know, so you have to go to the grand jury. The grand jury can deal with this problem and fix it. They don't have to send it to court. They can fix the problem. They can make make a contract with this person. They can make them do some, community service. And make the point that this was very dangerous and you can, kill somebody. So, yeah, again, common law is common sense. If someone's drinking, same thing, an officer of the law should stop that person. And they should take they should remove the keys from the car, call the tow truck, and they'll have to pay for the tow, ticket the person and take them home, not put them in jail. It's not necessarily a crime, okay? But they've endangered the public. And again, the grand jury has to answer for this because there's no direct injured party. It's, again, a community. So the grand jury can deal with this. And if the grand jury thinks there's a problem with alcoholism, they can require certain things and not allow that person to drive until they're convinced. They can be very creative with this. And we don't have to tie our courts up with all this. Most people will confess to their downfall, if you want to call it a crime. They'll confess to their downfall, and they'll go along and they'll pay the toll that has to be paid to fix them. Common law is all about fixing the problems, finding remedy, and trying to bring the people who are the violators of other people back into society. And if it's done right, we can return someone who has gone astray maybe and come back into society and become a good human being just like the rest of us, to the best that we can be anyway. And that's what common law is about. It's about justice. And the principles of common law is when those of us who are jurists or to become jurists, grand jurists or trial jurists, the idea of the principles is that we must have a sense of honor, a sense of justice, and a sense of mercy. And those are the tools we use when we go before and we look at a person who has done something wrong or possibly have done something wrong, and we have to judge them by using those tools. And we're looking for a solution, not for punishment. If we're looking for punishment, we're never going to solve the problem. Society will continue to go downhill.
different scenario dealing with a corporation. So let's say a corporation is suing an individual, for example, Monsanto suing a farmer because their patented seeds accidentally ended up in their fields. Would such an issue be addressed in a common law system at all?
Absolutely not. Corporation cannot sue a people. Corporation is an artificial entity. A people is a natural-born individual, one of the ordainers of the Constitution by heritage, and a corporation cannot sue them.
So I assume in a similar way, in dealings with the IRS, it would be a similar thing, right? Because the IRS is a corporate entity.
Right. Yeah, well, the IRS, well, look, at you know, the Supreme Court has ruled numerous times that the income tax is illegal, unconstitutional, and shouldn't go on. So, yeah, and yeah, they're a corporation. They can't sue the people. But you see, they bypass that with their word magic because they call you a person. If you read their paperwork, you're a person or a taxpayer, one or the other. And if you don't accept the taxpayer and you say, I'm not a taxpayer, they call you a person and you don't argue that point. Well, a person, if you go into code, U.S. Code 26, you discover that a person is a corporation. They've made people persons and made persons corporations. That's why you have a CESQ fund. When you were born, you got a birth certificate. And that's a docking paper. That means a birth, you know, birth of a ship, you know, bring it into the docks. That's what a birth certificate is. And so a lot of people are going to get alarmed by this if they don't know this, but they're being sold on the market as cattle. Everybody has a birth certificate. You're being sold, and they've been working on. That's called there's a CESQ fund. You have a certain value, and I heard right now the latest value is pretty high. It's $430 million. So each person, because they're corporations, they've been incorporated at birth with a certificate of birth. So they're a product, and they have a value, and that value, that CESQ fund is attached to that. And you'd be just totally amazed on how they play the money game. They make so much money off us on the markets. It's pathetic, and it's amazing how deep thinkers evil can be, I want to tell you.
Would you say that the nation's values were not really based on its hard assets, but really it's the people that were that's the value of each country?
Well, that's all we have left. That's all we have left is ourselves. They have totally destroyed our country, our nation. Keep making that same mistake. They've destroyed our nation. They've destroyed our manufacturing base. They've demoralized us. They've destroyed our money base. Money's not worth anything. You know, if you really look at the price of gold, for instance, in 1894, the an ounce of gold went for $18.95. That was the cost of an ounce of gold. Now today, I'm not sure where it's at right now, but it's still got to be up there, what, $1,500 maybe an ounce? So if you do the ratio, you find out that the value of a dollar is about something like 2 cents or a penny and a half or a penny and three quarters or something like that. That's pretty alarming. And that is why it takes two people in a family minimum, and they still can't have a problem surviving. Mom and dad both have to work. They try to push the child in school real early so they get that mind, that young mind, as early as they can so they can destroy it. Because believe me, that's what school does. You know, I'm not an educated person, not educated formally. I dropped out at eighth grade, but I'm self-educated. And so I haven't been corrupted by a lot of the things. I'm able to see these things, you know, reasonably quick, I think. But I think anyone can if they can kind of come to their senses and question what's going on and question the way it should be. So, you know, it's a mess.
The person you were referring to in the tax code, is that the same as a straw man? Or how would you define that?
As a matter of fact, yes. Yeah, I'm thinking of the straw man because I've been so involved with the committee man. But yes, it would be the same thing as a straw man. Meet your straw man. We have a video up online on that. And yes, so you've been incorporated, and that's your body. They'll call it the land. And they're very, very slick. Think about that. They're calling your body the land, L-A-N-D. And you know what? The Bible speaks of your body as land, too. It speaks of as the churches as land, the place where the seed is sown. But they're called, and so they kind of robbed that from the Bible. They've looked at this very carefully. But they call your body the land, or the product, or the corporation. And so what they're doing is they're seizing the corporation, or they're seizing your ship. They call it a ship, too. Or they're seizing your land. Now, the spirit is yours. And it's just, it's a shame that the spirit has to be attached to the body to go to jail for 20 years. You see, this is the game they're playing. But once you realize the game, there are ways to get around it, which I don't think we should talk about on radio.
A lot of people are under the misconception, getting back to the IRS topic, that if we don't pay our taxes, that we won't have money to build the infrastructure or pave roads and things like that. From your understanding, what do our tax dollars actually go toward?
Every single penny goes into the pocket of these criminals. Every single penny. Not one penny of your IRS. You pay into the IRS, you're paying the interest for the privilege of these people printing your money and destroying it. It's worthless. It's monopoly money. And they're about ready that, you know, people don't understand how simple it is to collapse a nation, how simple it is to take over a nation. People look around, things seem a little normal. Yeah, prices are high, times are hard, and so on and so forth. But, you know, how are they going to come out and do anything to us? We're too many. We're organized. You know, everything looks well, you know. But the bottom line is collapse the dollar, and they can do it. It was supposed to have happened, a lot of people who don't know, it was supposed to happen in October. You know, but the war in Syria didn't work out, and they had some other problems. That's why they closed the government down. That was part of the plan. By the end of the week, the dollar was supposed to be collapsed, and they were supposed to have a bank day. But that'll eventually come. It's just that it didn't work out, so they postponed it, and they moved it to another date. But the bottom line is all they have to do is collapse the monetary system. Now, just think about that. If they collapse the monetary system, every penny in your pocket is worthless. Every penny in the bank is worthless. You can't go to work because what are you going to do? Earn worthless money? So trucks don't move. Products don't move. I heard it said that we have maybe 3 or 7 days. I think it was 3 days worth of food on the shelves out there in the stores. And that's as long as nobody comes and rushes to take the food. If the economy collapsed, everybody would be rushing to the stores to get whatever they could. Okay, we'd be gone in a day. And then what are you going to do after that? If you haven't been storing up food and doing something to prepare for this, you're in trouble. And who's going to run the electric? The people who run the electric, they have families. They're trying to figure out how they're going to survive. You're not going to have any electric. Society is going to collapse. It's so simple to collapse society. And all they have to do is raise the price of metals. It's very simple. They've been manipulating metals for over 100 years. You know, gold is really underpriced. It's under, well, actually, let me think about that. It should be a lot higher than what it is, but because of the relationship of what's going on in the market. But it is still higher than silver and copper. So they keep the silver and copper as low as they could because silver and copper is necessary to keep societies moving. You know, you silver is a great conductor, and copper is a conductor also. And so, you know, you use wiring and computers, you know. So in order to keep the economy going, you got to really keep those prices down. So those are a little lower than what it should be, and gold is a little higher. But ultimately, gold has not reached where it should be right now. And what they're going to do at one day, you're going to wake up, and gold's going to be $5,000 an ounce, and or whatever it is, $4,000 an ounce. That's called hyperinflation. That's all they have to do is raise that, and they put us into hyperinflation. And silver and copper will go through the roof, and your dollar has no silver or gold in it. It's not backed by silver or gold. Your dollar's worthless. It's not. The whole, we'd have chaos in the streets. People would be killing each other. It would be a mess. And unless we can prepare for this, we're not going to be able to get through it. And that's one of the messages, of course, of a lot of the liberty groups. And it's also a problem that common law grand juries are going to try to solve as soon as they get into power, by talking with the sheriff and making sure he understands what his job is, and to make sure that we start preparing in every county in a state of an emergency. You know, all of the resources within a county belongs in that county. It belongs to that county. You know, the federal government has a plan to come and seize everything. No, they can't take it. and the sheriff has to protect it. And whatever overflow of resources, then it can overflow to the counties next door and they to us and eventually from state to state. And it'll continue some kind of a market, and we can at least survive through bartering and working together in groups of people in order to survive as we reestablish a new monetary system. But if we don't get law and order prepared for this kind of emergency that is coming up, we're going to be in trouble. You know, many of us have prepared with lots of food, different things. A lot of us will buy a lot of rice and sugar and flour, because those are the things that sort of the staple is flour and rice. People can survive on flour and rice. You may not be able to share a lot of meat with people, but if you can buy a lot of flour and rice, you can share bread and rice with people. And but people need to wake up to this and start preparing, because it's coming. And we're going to try to cut it off at the pass if we can. If the people understand the emergency and move quick enough, we can get these common law grand juries throughout the nation and we can seize back our courts. Let me tell you, a lot of people understand what Rothschild said, and he said, let me have control of a nation's money, and I don't care who makes the laws, I'll control them. And that's true, but he was deceptive. He left something out. He has to have control of the courts. If they don't control the courts, they can't control the money, because the court system can fix this. Common law can shut down the Federal Reserve literally overnight. Common law can require gold and silver to return because it's a wrongdoing. The United States Constitution requires only the states to only accept gold and silver as legal tender, coins, gold and silver coins. We have plenty of gold and silver coins still in moving around the country. We have copper, we have nickels. We have a lot of that stuff still out there, so we can kind of pull that back in and use that and start, you know, making coins again. We need to move back to coins. But the bottom line is that, we can move the system back, but the dollar's worth nothing, absolutely nothing. And when they collapse it, all of society is going to fall apart unless we can cut it off. So hopefully we can move quick enough. It's up to the people. We've been teaching a National Liberty Alliance. It's been echoing through the nation in every state now. Only the people can save America. Ron Paul can't do it. Electing some congressman can't do it. Getting a good governor can't do it. Only the people from the grassroots level, from every area of this country, every county, only the people can do it. And so if you're hearing this message, you need to do it or we're going to lose it.
From my understanding, the current legal system is based on the Bar Association, which is a corporation, right? And it's based in London, is that correct?
Well, it's even worse than that. It is a corporation, but they're a communist organization. They teach lawyers that this is the interesting thing. They teach lawyers that statutes are law. Statutes are not law. Codes are not law. Statutes and codes are written for the purpose of controlling commercial movement throughout the country and controlling our elected individuals, bureaucrats, and appointed individuals. That's what statutes and codes are for, not for people. But they've dumbed us down. So they are teaching lawyers that statutes are law. They teach their lawyers, the people who come out of law school. Okay, remember, the government has them, first of all, for 12 years. They got them through more than 12 years. You know, they got them maybe preschool and pre-preschool and then kindergarten, and then finally they get into first grade. So they get them real young. They're molding their mind. By the time they get through 8 grades and then they go to 4 grades of high school, now you're coming into adulthood. They've had hold of you from the very beginning right up to the point you're entering your adulthood. And then, of course, if you go into the quote-unquote lower education, that they call a higher education, for more, mind control, then you're destroyed even more. But they teach these people that statutes are law, and they are true believers. They teach these people that common law is passé, has been done away since 1850, and they're true believers. They teach these people that the grand jury is no longer viable, that it's controlled by the courts, and that they have done away with this also And they're all over the place with this. Some of them say the early 1800s. Some of them say the mid 1800s. Some say the late 1800s. Some say the early 1900s. Some say in 1939, particularly here in New York, and in 1948. And they're not even sure. They're all over the place with that one. But that's not true. Well, common law is still here. How can you void out God? How can you void out nature? How can you void out the person? How can the legislators who are under the Constitution rule against the Constitution, come above the Constitution, change the Constitution, and rule over the people? Well, of course they can't do it. That's sedition. But they're true believers. They really are. And that's what you fight in court with. And you have to really, you know, they're in a fictional world. They truly believe that they're in reality. They think that we're crazy. But as time goes on, if you run your court case right, they sit there scratching their head, you confuse them, and it becomes a problem for them because they're met with reality and they're seeing it, and yet they can't do anything. Unfortunately, I think most lawyers and judges are illiterate. It's not a joke either because they don't seem to like to read. They don't read your cases. I've seen cases go by where the judges just don't read. Finally, they read it, and then they go into cardiac arrest because they understand their flesh is now on the line. There's kind of a difference between going into a state court and a federal court. You know, the federal courts, I think the judges are a lot more sophisticated. They're paying attention. They're conscious from the very beginning. And as soon as you put their flesh on the line, you maneuver the court and box that judge in. And he realizes his flesh is on the line. He has his private conversation with the lawyer out back. Fix this case because it ain't going no further. Fix it. Make a deal. Fix it. Okay? Because the judge will not allow himself to go down with the ship. Okay? In the state courts, they're too stupid to know that they're going to go down with the ship. And you end up suing them. And that's it's a mess.
How did the Bar Association come into power? And it sounds to me like if it's based in London, it would suggest that that we've always been under the rule of English, at least since the bars exist under the rule of England. Does that make any sense?
Well, yeah, if they control the judicial system, they control the political system, they control the monetary system, they control everything. So you're absolutely right. The Bar Association, I know, was around in the days when our founders were putting things together and rebelling. And they knew it was a problem, and they very specifically wrote it into the Constitution that nobody can come with a title of nobility. They were talking about lawyers. And they made it a lot clearer with the 13th Amendment, which was written, goodness, early 1800s. But it seemed to disappear by the time we got to the 1850s, and it was no more. It just disappeared from before us. But there's plenty of proof that the 13th Amendment did exist before the 13th Amendment that exists right now, which is the freeing of the slaves. There was another one. And that one made it very clear about no member, ultimately, that nobody has a title, could hold any office or any office of authority. You know, you couldn't be elected. If you look to see what has happened, our political realms are and judicial realms are nothing but bar lawyers. Everywhere you look, there's a bar lawyer. How often do you get a Ron Paul, someone who was a medical doctor, you know? And they have their problems too, by the way, but Ron Paul seems to have passed through that. But in any event, you know, almost everybody seems to be a lawyer that's in government. And dozens and dozens and hundreds of lawyers. I remember calling up to the assembly in New York here a few years back when they were changing the boundary lines for the election districts, and because we had lost a couple of congressmen. Like I said, we were 29, went to 28, so they had to change all the boundaries, and things were being screwed around. And they didn't get out. We were waiting for the booklet to come out for the calendar for the elections. And I remember calling up numerous times and talking with some of the leaders up there, trying to get a pulse on what was going on so we know what we were going to do, because we were doing the committee man thing. And we were also walking papers for good people who we thought were good. Boy, did they fool us. But in any event, and they started talking, when I was talking with them, they started talking about the lawyers. What the hell are you talking about, the lawyers? And they had lawyers writing this stuff, but I thought they were supposed to write. I thought Congress was supposed to write the laws. Why does Congress go out and hire lawyers to write this stuff and work this stuff out? So they not only have lawyers in there, they have lawyers who don't even write the stuff, and they hire out other lawyers, and the whole thing is a mess. So we're a country of run by lawyers, and everybody hates lawyers. They know that lawyers, I know that lawyers are evil, but everybody hates lawyers. And so we have an entire country run by lawyers, and they all believe that statutes are law, and therein is the problem. And until the people step up and say, no, statutes are not law. And you can't have two or three. You have to have people in every county. And that's why we at National Liberty Alliance are working. Our goal, our ultimate goal, is to create 3,143 common law grand juries in 3,143 counties across this nation. And only then can we stand up and overtake them. They will not be able to resist the people when they stand up from that kind of a position with authority and with power. And we hope to accomplish that this year.
I know there's a lot happening there in New York in your process of setting up the grand juries. You just issued a mandamus recently. Can you, for people who don't know what a mandamus is, can you explain what that is and what exactly has transpired with that process so far?
Right. Yeah, the first time I came into understanding about a mandamus was about 2 years ago. We tried to get a mandamus. We discovered a mandamus, and we tried to get a mandamus done in New York, which we were looking for the higher courts, which would be the appellate courts here in New York, to order the lower courts, which was the trial court, to obey the law because they were not obeying the law. And it was so quite surprising, and if it wasn't so serious, it would be funny. But they had no clue on what a mandamus was. Even the attorney general who took over the case, New York State Attorney General's office, they took over the case because they wanted to squash this case. And they had no clue on what the process, what we wrote a paper, and they wrote a paper back. It didn't even make any sense. When we got up to the appellate court, we ended up just staring them down, literally, you know. We pulled on them what they pull on the people, but they had no clue. They didn't understand. They may have understood, but they didn't want it to go through. So what a mandamus is ultimately for a higher court to command a lower court to obey a law or a certain thing. A mandamus can go out also from a court to an individual. You know, if someone is in office and they're not obeying a law, you can go to the courts and have the courts order them to obey. It's called a writ of mandamus. But they've done away with that. 1949, they've done away with the writ of mandamus here in New York, and that's why they don't know anything about it. All of these extraordinary writs, they ignore the writ of habeas corpus, which has produced the body. The writ of mandamus is which we command you. All of these extraordinary writs they've done away with. But we studied to see where did that actually come from. And it comes from the king's bench. It's an order from the king himself, through his body, okay, which is ultimately is the his other judges. That's what it's referred to in the older languages, his other judges. And they're reflectors of the king. They reflect the will of the king. And that's where the grand jury comes in. You see, the grand jury are the judges, okay, or the trial jury are the judges, and they reflect the will of the king. And the will of the king, you know, we the people too, but we reflect in the will of the people. And the will of the people is the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, their unalienable rights. That's the will of the people, to be free, to have a heritage. And so that's what it's called also the king's bench. So the writ of mandamus emanates out from the king's bench, and it is a letter directly to some individual or somebody commanding them to obey the law, and under penalty of law. If they don't do it, the king could take the head off. We take the head off by indicting. And so since they didn't command a grand jury here in New York, the unified grand jury, which is a total of, at this point, of 18 grand juries, came together and decided to indict these two people who wouldn't obey. It's a judge up in Greene County, and it's also a clerk in Greene County. They decided to get involved in a conspiracy with other judges that we indicted here in New York for them. Two of the highest judges in New York were indicted down in New York City, and two others, a total of four. And so they decided to get involved in what's called felony rescue and conspiracy. These judges sent notes, memorandums to all the clerks and all of the courts and of the counties to tell them to ignore the common law grand jury and that they weren't real and they had no authority and so on and so forth. And so they decided, we explained to them very carefully where the authority came from and what we were doing in the right of the people. We showed them the court cases. And then we send them the writ of mandamus. And now, following behind that, will be two more true bills. So we're going through an indictment. It's really called a presentment when the grand jury brings it on their own, but it's still the same thing. It's an indictment, and we'll be going down to see the sheriff shortly for having them be arrested.
You mentioned that you explained to them what gives you the authority to do this. And can you explain where that authority comes from?
Sure. The authority comes from the people, ultimately. It comes from the Bill of Rights. It comes from the Constitution, the people who wrote the Constitution. And they put in the Fifth Amendment the right of a trial by jury. And so it speaks about the people having to approve of anything that the government does in a legal way. That's why you need a trial jury or a grand jury. People have the right of a trial by grand jury, and the grand jury has the authority to trial by jury. But the grand jury, they have to be indicted, and they can be indicted by through the state bringing the case to the grand jury, and then they do an indictment or a presentment. We also find the language in the New York state constitution. I believe it's Article 1, goodness, I think it's somewhere around number 10, subsection 10, but it's in the very beginning where it talks about the right of the grand jury and that the grand jury will never be done away with. It's an eternal thing being in this state, and that's what makes it very interesting because they seem to claim it's not there. But in any event, that authority comes from there. In the case of United States versus Williams, Justice Scalia did an amazing amount of research. It probably has been something he'd been working in for years, and I think he finally had the chance. He was getting old, and I think he's in his 80s now. He's up there. But back in 92, he seemed to put it out there in the case United States versus Williams, and it came out in what's called dicta. It's not on point. The difference between dicta and on point, people will use the United States Supreme Court rulings on the appellate level, which is the U.S. Supreme Court. They'll use their rulings to support their cases because their rulings and decisions have to be obeyed by all judges. There's no choice. There's two different kinds of rulings. Something on point is that the case is very, very similar, and so it's a very strong on-point decision. In dicta is something that they kind of added, but they're not necessarily directly related to the case you're in, but it's still a fact and it's true and it's law. But on point is stronger than dicta. But even though a lot of what he had to say was dicta, he gave just numerous references to other Supreme Court rulings that were on point, and that was the key. It was really a well-done a document. Anybody who wants to read the United States versus Williams, it's on our front page, and a lot of the strong points are highlighted in yellow. He went on to say that the grand jury is a fixture all onto its own, that it's not mentioned anywhere in the Constitution, and that it's found only in the Bill of Rights, which makes it an unalienable right, and that the grand jury was to be impaneled and controlled ultimately by the people themselves. And that he even said, and many other courts have said this also, that they themselves do not have the authority or the power to overrule the jury or the grand jury. So once a jury or a grand jury rules, that's it. You can't overrule it. Now, there is one exception to that, and that is, for instance, if someone's unalienable rights was offended by a rule of the grand jury or trial jury, then the United States Supreme Court does have the authority to step in and fix that problem. The other thing, of course, is let's say some evidence came up that made it obvious the person wasn't guilty. Obviously, the grand jury realizes that there was some wrongdoing happened. They got to go fix it. The United States Supreme Court can fix it, or the grand jury or the trial jury can't fix it, but the grand jury can fix it. They can do a habeas corpus, pull the body out of jail and free it. So, and that was the power and the authority of the habeas corpus, and they've made that irrelevant. You hardly even hear about a habeas corpus here in the United States anymore, and it's one of the most important and most powerful writs out there, because it's the power of the king to take someone literally out of jail or out of harm's way, away from the government, bring it before them, and free them. That's powerful. And it's important that the people have that kind of authority.
So your next step is to have these individuals, this judge and a clerk as well, arrested. Do you anticipate that you're going to have to involve the Superior Court in any way?
Well, we don't know. They've been disobedient continuously. We keep putting the pressure on. We know they fear us, and they should. They better. When the government fears the people, we have liberty. I think it was Benjamin Franklin said that. Jefferson. When the people fear the government, you have tyranny. When the government fears the people, you have liberty. And so they do fear us, and that's a good, healthy thing. You know, the Bible even speaks of that. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of all wisdom and understanding. Well, the fear of the people, who is the creator of government, is the beginning of their wisdom and understanding. They do fear us. We have come out after them. We've got lots of steps to take. We have lots of tools that our founding fathers have given us. We've been utilizing them and using them. We indicted four judges, and we filed the papers with the clerk in Greene County. And they're not doing anything. Unfortunately, our sheriffs are not educated enough, nor do they have the guts yet, because they're not educated enough to do something about this. So to explain to them how things work and force them to go arrest these people, it's probably impossible, because if we were in the courts, we put a court order out, it would happen. But we're not in the courts yet. We're fighting to get into the courts. And so to arrest those people, the sheriff's not going to do it. But we understood that the power would be in the filing of the paperwork, because in the filing of the paperwork is codes. And it tells them how to operate and what to do. And there's numerous U.S. codes, and in our case, there's a lot of New York codes. And it says that any piece of paper, in simple terms, any piece of paper going down the judicial process that is filed with the clerk can't play tribunal and reject it. They don't have a choice but just to accept it and file it. That's all they can do. If they reject it or refuse to file it, they face, I believe it's 1 to 3 years in jail. If anybody, once a paper is filed in with the clerk, it has a judicial process it goes through. And this judicial process has been around in our country for 200 years. Every court in the entire nation has the same process. Paper goes in, and it goes through down sort of the conveyor belt of justice, let's say. And so it goes to the next step. It goes into the file, and it goes over to the judge, and the judge's hand is forced to pick up his pen and sign it. Can't question it, can't do nothing. If he tries to stop it, 20 years in jail for a judge who interferes. Okay, so he has no choice but to pick up the pen and sign the paper. And then it goes back into the file and down the conveyor belt. It goes out to the prosecutor. The prosecutor gets it, starts to prepare the case. He makes contact with the grand jury to make sure he's got all the evidence and all the paperwork. He understands the case. And then he starts to get ready for the case. He'll contact the lawyers on the other side. They'll get together with the judge. They'll start to put it on the docket. And nothing can stop that. That's what the United States versus Williams was all about. And many, many other court cases, none of them have ever been overturned, nor have they won. Anytime a grand jury has filed a paper and gone through the process, nobody can stop it. And that's what the United States Supreme Court says. Now, these people stopped it. They committed felony rescue. They committed treason. They committed conspiracy. They did. We have like about 40 or 50, I don't know. We got a lot of violations that fits right into what they've done. But that was some of the bigger ones. We also now at a point where we can use the word RICO, and that should put a chill right up their spine. So that's where we're at. And now we're going to take these laws, which are very obvious. See, these are codes now. Sheriffs know about codes. Cops know about codes. They operate by codes. And when they see a code and they say, okay, how do we interpret that code? There's a book interpreting that. That's it right there. This is what happens. They get arrested. And what are they facing? They're facing up to 3 years in jail. That's it. They don't have it. They have to obey that. That's a statute. That's a law for them. So all we lack here is the witnesses. So that's why we went up there and we spoke with these people personally, and we pushed them forward to push this paperwork. We got a copy of the paperwork. We found out it's never been officially filed, so she failed to file it. We made notice to the judge that this paper is here and hasn't been filed, and we told him, take care of this, make sure it moves through the process. He has ignored it. So they're both involved with felony rescue and conspiracy. They're being obedient to the other criminals who have already been indicted. And so we got three people who are writing affidavits, and an affidavit, of a crime that has been committed. So once you have three witnesses that write an affidavit, bring it the complaint to the sheriff with the laws, the sheriff has he can't do anything but arrest. And if he doesn't arrest, then he's guilty of felony rescue, and we go see his undersheriff. Now, there's another thing to do if that doesn't work, and I'm not ready to speak about that until we're ready to do it, but it is an atomic bomb. It's very strong. And hopefully we'll get it through there at that point. But there's lots of things to do. There's pressure of the people, and more grand juries are coming on board, and all of that is more and more pressure. They have sent the FBI out on us three times. They send it out on the grand jury down in Bronx, New York. They send it out on the grand jury in Orange County, New York. And they send it out, where's the third time? I don't remember where the third time was. Actually, it was four because I had the FBI in my house. But there was four times altogether. Each and every time the FBI walked away. And realize that there's nothing they're going to do here. So that's a good thing. And they understand that they can't get involved in this. So, as a matter of fact, one of them we took to the point where they started asking us questions, and we turned it around and started drilling them. And we let them know, well, we have an investigation going on him, and we brought a bunch of witnesses to talk with them. They got all frightened and realized that they need to leave. And actually, that guy said, look, if you guys need help, let me know. So we may go down and see him.
Now, I understand that your ultimate vision is that each county is going to have several administrators who serve the people.
Right.
Other than a case having to go to court, the administrators may actually resolve these issues before that needs to happen. Is that how you perceive
that? Well, exactly. And that's set up on the principles of the Magna Carta was set up. And it takes the job away from the prosecutor who tries to play the game and make the decision. He doesn't have the authority to make a decision or a deal with anyone. That authority does not exist. That's the people's job. It's not the prosecutor's job. He's hired help. But, yeah, what we have constructed was four administrators per county. Now, some counties may need more than four administrators, but that's the minimum of four. Obviously, down in New York City, you go into the Bronx, you probably need eight, maybe 12. I don't know. You're going to need a lot more than you would up where I'm at, Dutchess County. But four is the minimum. Four is the number chosen mostly because of the Magna Carta, where the grand jury, if someone was to notify the jury that they have been violated and they're looking for justice, it is the authority, it is the right and the duty of the grand jury to fix it. And what happens is they send out four people. It could be less than four people, but that's generally the number. And that's why we chose four. So they send out four people to investigate the matter and try to settle it. They will do everything they can to settle it. If you go read the Magna Carta, that's how it really worked. They try to settle the problem. And if the four cannot settle the problem, they bring it to the 25, and the 25 will consider the indictment. And that's how it works. So the four is, you know, we call ourselves administrators because we're not acting in the capacity of the grand jury, but we're acting under the authority of the grand jury. And we're sent out to investigate. And in theory, when you take this beyond that, any four people anywhere in this country, if they believe something is going wrong someplace, and they have the authority and the ability, those four people, to walk into a an office. And what we're doing is we're setting up a directory, which will have access to the other four, you know, the four administrators. So if somebody was to call up and say, hey, you know, there's some crimes going on down in this office down here, and there were four of us, we want to go down and investigate it. And they say, okay, fine. The administrator will make the phone call to the office and say, we're sending down an investigative body. They'll be there tomorrow at 1 o'clock, right after lunch, or whatever the case may be. So when they walk in, they'll have all the authority to walk. Any four people can walk into the building and start an investigation. After all of us are the people. All of us are the kings. We're the owners of this country. They work for us. We're the boss, and the boss is walking into the office. I'm checking up to see what's going on. They can get access right into their computers. They can talk to people. They can take them aside and talk to them. And once they discover the problem, it's their job to make a prescription. And the prescription would be, you know, to bring them back under the law, under the what's required for them to do. And once they do that, they serve that on them, and they'll serve a copy over to the grand jury. And as long as everything's fine and they do the right thing, it's fine. If they don't obey it, then those four people have the opportunity to bring it before the 25 and bring their case to say this is the violation. And the 25 will make the decision whether they're going to indict or not. So instead of the prosecutor doing it, the people. How much more powerful is the people than the prosecutor? So now they'll try to, the enemy of liberty will try to distort this and to say we became the 25 and we want to control everything and we want to make all decisions and these people are going to be in power and they're from a corner and they're a few and they're this. You know, we're not the grand jury. We are the administrators of the grand jury. We are the investigative body of the grand jury. We can be called also a board of review of the grand jury. Whatever it is, the people's review, board of review. So if any group of people can go in and figure something out, and they should call the grand jury up in their county so that they're aware of what they're doing and they can make the phone call of introduction so they don't get resisted. They make the call and say, hey, we're sending down a body of an investigation. We the people, four people are coming down. Mike, Joe, Mary, and Larry, whatever. Okay? They don't need last names. They don't get that. They make a big thing. You know, the enemies of freedom again make the vote. Oh, it's so secretive. You don't give your last names. Well, how many people, how many grand jury or trial jury does the court release any of their names? No. Why? It's secret. They don't want retaliation. Okay? The juries don't have to release their names to nobody. It wouldn't be wise to do that. And surely the courts can't do it. If they did, whoever did it's going to go to jail. Okay? So we're not doing anything different than the way it operates. But we're a respectful body, and we have principles. We act under, again, a sense of honor, sense of justice, and a sense of mercy. These people that are doing this right now, they have no sense of honor. They have no sense of justice. They have no sense of mercy.
Now, these are all, the administrator positions are ultimately going to be paid positions, right?
Correct.
Where does the money come from to pay these positions?
Well, right now, there is a budget, that budget allows for the court to have so much money in order to impanel, you know, call and impanel and whatever's necessary to pull a grand jury together. They go through the orientation. What's very interesting, I got a copy of that. I got a copy on the federal, which is a form to be filled out for every potential jurist. And I can't believe the questions they ask. They have no business asking any questions. We don't ask any questions. We just orientate the people. There's a few questions we might ask. We're going to be talking about things, but, you know, we haven't concluded on that yet. But there'll be obvious questions that should be obviously asked, maybe two or three. But in any event, you know, we get to orientate them. Right now, the state is orientating them. They have these long forms they fill out, so it's a psychological real thing that they're really doing. And they have total control over these people. And when the jury goes into the court, the judge lets them know, okay, you get to decide the facts, but I get to decide the law. So the fix is in. They've already they're going to prove that they violated the statutes. That's a no-brainer. And they're going to be found guilty because the judge says you have to find them guilty. So very rarely does a trial jury stand up to a judge. It does happen from time to time. It's called jury nullification. You know? The law is unjust. There's no injured party. This is not right. We're not going to give it to you. So now in the grand jury, same thing. You have everybody's heard the statement from the prosecutor that they can indict a ham sandwich. Well, they're absolutely right. They take the jury by the ring of the nose and they tell them what to do. They interpret everything. They're going to get their indictment. Believe me, they always get their indictment. It's very rare if they don't. Very rare. They get their indictment. So where is the honesty? Where is the honor? Where is the fairness? Where is the mercy? Where is the people in this whole process? Certainly they're not in the courts because these criminals are controlling everything. Okay? And that's why they don't want us here. Because they don't want us here because they're all going to jail. Now, we're not going in for a witch hunt. Don't get me wrong. But we're going in as long as they're obedient and understand they're going to go along with the common law. They have no choice. They can resign. They can obey, or they can be indicted. And we're not going to tell them they're going to be indicted. We're going to tell them we're going to bring them before the grand jury, and they're probably going to indict you. And he should know that, and she should know that. So they have the three choices they have. And as long as they go along with the law, then everything's good. We're not on a witch hunt. We're not there to put them in jail. I don't care what they've done in their past. We're going forward. We're here to save the republic. But it is unfortunate for them, because a lot of these guys or women have skeletons in their closet, and we'll get some phone calls from somebody saying, you know, let me tell you what this guy done to me, or to my children, or to us, and we have to hear it. And if there was an injury here, well, we have a principle to go by. For every injury, there must, not like, nice to be, no, there must be a remedy. So now we got to pull the judge out, and we got to try to figure this out. Can we remedy this without going to court? You know, so that's what the people, the 25 people right there at the grassroots in that county have to figure out. Nobody else has any anything to say. This is what those 25 people have to decide. And that's how our founding fathers set it up. That's how it was set up from the Magna Carta. And you could trace this all the way back into the Bible.
Can you talk a little about the different levels of involvement if people want to get involved in the National Liberty Alliance and the Common Law Grand Jury, and also where do they go to get involved?
Right. Well, you can go out to nationallibertyalliance.org, read the front page, watch the video on the front page. It's a really good overview of what we're doing. And if you're interested in getting involved at that point, most people aren't interested when they get to that point, then all you have to do is sign up right online. You register online. When you're registering, you are registering as a jurist, which means you're going into a jurist pool. And the first jurist we will call will be out of that pool. When we exhaust that pool, then we'll go over to probably the voters registration, and we'll pull people there without concern of party right out of that pool. And the key thing is we get to orientate them, to tell them what the law is, what common law is, how it works. So we'll get 4 to 8 hours just like they get. We get it. We, the people, it's our – we'll show the people what the law is, and the law is common law. Now, anybody who is interested in getting more involved, they can – when they sign up, they can check a button to become a county organizer. County organizer, they work to organize their county. If they don't have a grand jury, they work to create a grand jury with others. They don't have to take on the job of the four, but they can help the four. We found that even the people who don't sign up for the county organizers, they come out to the voting and they're involved, not as much as the organizers would be. Now, from those people, will emerge four people who are very interested in really boning up on the common law, boning up on the legal process. Maybe already they got some background in it, and really trying to understand how the whole thing works and would like to take on the job as an administrator. So the four most qualified people will take that job on. Now, how do you I have found that, you know, a lot of people aren't interested in that job, but some are. In my county, there's two of us so far, and we're looking for two more. We'll find them. They'll emerge. And so it's really not a battle for the position. But if it does become a battle for the position, I think then the county organizers need to get together and make a decision on who they think is the most qualified people to take those positions, because we do need people who are willing to go out to become re-educated, to learn really what common law is all about, and to understand the process, and are willing to learn the judicial process, procedures, and how things work. And that's pretty much it. When people get the phone call that are in the jurors pool, you know, they're not forced to come in. Nobody can force anyone to do anything. So they get the call. They'll be told, hey, we got a case coming up. It's going to be on these dates. It's going to be about so many days. And, you know, we're calling you, and can you come in? And hopefully they can. But if they can't, they can say, I can't, and we'll just put their name back into the to pool, and maybe they'll get a call in a couple of months or next year or something, you know. But so no one's forced to participate, but surely you're going to want to do your best to participate, because that's your job as one of the people, and none of us should be derelict of that duty. But it's understandable, you know, if you have a situation going on, you got a business, important meetings, and whatever it is, you know, fine, we'll get someone else. We'll get back to you another day. We'll see what you can do. So that's how it works, and that's pretty much it. It's pretty simple.
In your vision of the future, how do you foresee common law grand juries impacting the day-to-day lives of Americans? Like, what do you think will change based compared to what it is now?
Yeah, I think we'll be back. We will be setting the political clocks back to 1789. We're going to go back to the beginning of our country, where then it's going to be reset to where it used to be. You know, one of the good thing that could come out of this is the lesson to be learned, you know, and the history to be written. You know, there's an old saying, you know, if you forget your history, it's going to repeat itself. So this history needs to be written, and we need to teach it to our children. And we must never succumb to this again. If the people were alert as grand jurists, no new world order could potentially, possibly ever infiltrate this country. No communist movement, no Nazi movement, nothing can infiltrate this country and take it over if the people are conscious of the problem. And all they have to do is just be conscious of the fact that it's up to them to take control of their country by serving as a jurist or a grand jurist, and also at some point in their life as a committee man. Everyone should look to do that at some point in their life. And those who could take the important roles of administrators, of course, they would do that. But I see in the beginning our focus is to save the republic. Our focus is to organize and get things ready so that if we have a collapse, we'll be able to survive it with the proper communications and the proper, control by the sheriff and not the federal government. And if we can do that and continue on as a people, then we'll accomplish our goal. That's what our goal is. But maybe we can cut it off before they even pull the collapse. Maybe the collapse will never come. Maybe we'll be blessed with that. But in any event, once we save the republic and secure it, the next order of business is people will be aware of our existence at that point, and we'll be getting a lot of phone calls. We'll probably be very busy for quite some time. But that, I think, will slow down, and eventually the court systems will slow down. I think we'll have a lot less court cases because we're not going to be bringing all this garbage that they bring in. You know, they have a business putting people in jail. It's very important to them to get people in jail. First of all, it's a business. They make money. And once people have a record, then they can't have a weapon either. You know, they can't get a permit, which we're going to do away with that because we shouldn't have a permit. But in any event, the point is we will get to a point where I think most of the problems between the people or between the government and the people, most of those problems will be able to be dealt with by the four, and we'd be able to work out a reasonable contract so that the injured party could be restored, and I think there'll be a lot less court cases. So we'll also save a lot of money for the people by this process also. So we'll get back to sanity is what we'll get back. And we'll get back to people rule, and we'll get back to a place where our children will grow up the way we want them to grow up. People in their communities will be able to decide what their children are going to learn, and they can decide how moral they want to be. You know, if you have a Jewish community and they want to, you know, put the Old Testament in there or whatever they want to do, that's their business. You know, if you don't like it, you can move to the next town over, maybe to a Christian community. Maybe a Christian community wants to put the Bible in the school. Maybe they don't. Look it, people get to decide. You know, Thomas Jefferson said, we don't have government by majority. We have government by the majority who participate. And so if you have 1,000 families in a school district, and a meeting is called for the parents of those children to come down, and they're going to make some decisions, and 10 parents show up, 10 families, 10 parents show up, well, they're going to go forward, and they're going to make the decisions. And if anybody complains later on, well, they have no reason to complain. Why didn't you come to the meeting? Why didn't you voice your opinion? Why didn't you make your case? Why didn't you push your point? You know, we're going to be doing this again in next year or 2 years from now. Make sure you come down that time. And if you don't, hey, well, what can I tell you? Look, the people decide what they want. Not the government, not special interest groups, the people. And if the people, you know, if you got an atheist community and that's the people, let them do what they want. It's their business. That's people business. So we'll truly have a place for the people to rule themselves once we get to that point.
Do you believe as a society we've crossed the point of no return toward a better future, or do you still feel that we have a long way to go?
Well, it is true. You know, if people step up and become educated, it's in their hands. If they truly become educated and not again snook it again, then I think they can do the right thing. You know, that answer, I think, can only be done by God. The bottom line to this whole thing is either God's going to bless our work or he's not. This is his law. You know, the God of the universe, he's the one who created the nature that we have, the logic that we have. And so therefore he created the justice. And again, Black's Law Dictionary, all the legal dictionaries agree on this, that the word justice is synonymous with the word virtue. It comes from virtue. And so that's what we need to get back to. And if we can get back to a judicial system of true justice, the best that we can, you know, when we make decisions, we know at night we can go home and sleep. We've done the best we can do. And that's all that's expected of any of us. And if we do that, then there's a good chance that we will be blessed by the governor of the universe. And if the governor of the universe blesses us and decides that's the route, then we'll make it. You know, it's a hard question to answer. We're doing the best to get to that point, and we're praying that that's where we'll end up. So, but it's up to the people. Only the people can save America. Only the people can now get up and do the right thing and take control of their future.
What compels you personally to do what you do?
God.
So I want to wind things up for today. What's if you had a final word of wisdom or words of wisdom to give to people, what do you think is the most important message that you want our listening audience to gain from this interview?
That's a big question. I guess I'd like to end it with a Bible verse. Justice and judgment are the inhabitants of thy throne. Mercy and truth shall go before thy face. And that's Psalms 89:14.
Thank you so much, John, for taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk to me today. Yeah, it was very nice, very informative. Good luck to everything you're doing, and I look forward to getting more personally involved myself.
All right, God bless you. Godspeed, everyone. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.